know the name.
We got no, I was there. So
these two people.
Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order and open an informational meeting on to get a report from the Task Force on Primary and Mental Health Care Reimbursement that came out of House Bill 2902. We'll get a status report from them, and I'll invite Dr. Richard Kincaid, who's joined us via telemedicine link that we won't be billed for, right?
That's right. No reimbursement issues here.
Dr. Kincaid, have at it, please.
Great. Thank you, Representative Greenlick. I am a family physician from Eugene and currently am co-chair of the Task Force for Primary and Mental Health Care Reimbursement. This task force originated out of House Bill 2902. I am hopeful that Sandy has been able to provide you with our report to the interim session, so hopefully you have that available, and I won't waste your time reading it. I would like to point out that, again, this task force was convened after issues related to reimbursement for physician assistants, nurse practitioners, and physicians for similar services was discussed at the 77th Legislative Assembly, and at that juncture of time, the task force was convened to look at that issue in more detail. In the moment, as of January of this year, there is parity across those three different types of providers for the services, and that parity will exist and then for a period of time, and then is sunsetted in that period of, in that interim time. Our task force is really designed to look at payment structures to assure that providers are compensated fairly, and that whatever payment structure we put into place as a state and support would be one that would promote the primary care and mental health workforce, which many are aware of is in significant lacking a significant number of providers at this time. So we met in January, and so as your report will say, we reviewed the deliverables of the task force, and out of that felt that it was worth our time for a much more in-depth study around different payment structures and payment reform models that support primary and behavioral health care. So that process will move forward, and over the next year, prior to the next legislative session, our hope is that we'll be able to provide the legislature with a series of more comprehensive payment reform recommendations for the state that will help to address these issues. So, again, we part of our responsibility is to report to the healthcare committee for the House, and so that is what we're doing today. We look forward to further dialogue and some in-person discussions with this group, particularly as we begin to formulate some possible legislative solutions to some of these challenges. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions of the committee, and we look forward to further participation over the coming year.
Yes. Representative Katie Geyer, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Kincaid. And I just want to make sure that what's on OLIS, there's a one-page. Is that, am I
yes,
missing anything else?
A one-page report.
It's a one-page report. Okay, thank you. And I also have a list of the members that I don't think was a part of that. But I'm wondering, Dr. Kincaid, if you can just go through the members and let us know which may be more in the area of primary care versus behavioral health or mental health, and which might be rural versus urban. I know we're, you know, seeking to have a really good balance of that.
Great question. The list of the members are on the top part of the report. We have both members from, obviously, legislative members and non-legislative members. It was stipulated that this 13-member task force had some very specific requirements as to who was to participate in the task force. So we have representatives from both primary care and behavioral health. We have both rural and urban representatives.
Yeah.
And then we have representatives that also have the interests of the hospitals as well as the insurers. I think with that constellation of providers, I think we have a pretty good sense. Fortunately, we have very engaged legislative members who have been following this issue for some time and I think have a fairly a good perspective, I think it's a fairly balanced committee. The good part about any type of task force is we can bring content experts as we look at particularly workforce issues, so we're hopeful that we will get the type of information that we need and the decisions out of this task force that will be helpful for the legislature.
So that's great, and I don't know in terms of the nurse representative, the PA as well as the nurse practitioner representatives, if they're more primary care. I can see the names.
No.
I see the names. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if they're more of a primary care or mental health. I think what I would just encourage is that as you seek subject matter experts or as you perhaps form smaller task groups, that, you know, the it had to be a small committee of 13 in order to just function. But you have a big job as a physician, a family care doc, to make sure that you really include the behavioral health side, since this is mental health as well. So the psychiatrists, and likewise, I'm not sure, the nurse practitioner and the PAs, you know, what fields they come from. But likewise, I would hope that they would really make sure that they're reaching out to their respective communities in order to really represent the different views, because I know it's very different issues of access and reimbursement challenges in those different areas, as it is urban and rural, and those are the things that we're really hoping you gather information on so that we can make a good decision upon sunset of the bill.
Very good. I appreciate that quite a bit. Our representatives are mostly focused in primary care, but those of us that do primary care understand the critical nature of an integrated care delivery model. So we will make sure we have that well represented.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
And it sounds like you want to have a more intensive interaction with us. We meet next, the last week in May, I expect the Wednesday after Memorial Day. Representative Lively is our representative on your group, and if you coordinate with Representative Lively, if you need time with us in May, we'll do everything we can to schedule whatever time you need for us to react to where you are at that point.
That would be fabulous. Thank you.
Are there any other questions of Dr. Kincaid? Representative Lively couldn't be here today, so I'm sure he'll be keeping us informed in addition. Dr. Kincaid, thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
It's my pleasure. I look forward to some further dialogue.
And for those of you that have missed it, the preliminary report from this committee is on OLIS and in our material. Thank you very much, sir. You're welcome to stay and join us. It's going to be a lot of fun, I think.
Well, I appreciate the invitation. I'm busy trying to figure out how to create a payment system for primary care and behavioral health integration in Lane County. So that's where I'm headed to right now.
And see your patients as well. We need lots of primary care access. I'm going to close the informational meeting. Thank you very much for attending. I'm going to close the meeting on the task force of primary mental health care reimbursement. And open up a meeting on stabilization and crisis unit. My intention is to call a couple of folks from DHS for the program to introduce the program to us so we know what it is we're talking about. And then we'll have some folks from AFSCME who will be talking to us about the issues of workers in these programs and how they're faring. So can I call Jana McClellan and Brad Health. That can't be. Is that right?
Heath.
Keith. Oh, all right. Okay. Well, he spelled it with an L. He's just trying to confuse us.
We would never try and confuse you, Chair.
We're easily confused.
Good afternoon, Chair, Vice Chair, and Committee. Thank you very much for letting us come today. I want to take just a few minutes, as Representative Greenlick mentioned, and give you an overview of the Stabilization and Crisis Unit.
Please introduce
my yourself. My name is Jana McClellan. I am the new, I like to continue to consider myself new, Director of the Stabilization and Crisis Unit. I've been in this position 10 months and 11 days. As I like to tell people, I am still counting until the first year is behind me. I have with me Brad Heath, who is the clinical services manager of our organization. The context, I think, of what you're going to hear today from the AFSCME representatives and leadership behind me is best served if I can give you a little bit of history or perspective on who the agency is. Stabilization and Crisis Unit has been in place since January 3rd of this year. Prior to that, it was the state-operated community programs, SOCP, which the legislature established as it closed Fairview. Our target population are adults and kids with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Most all of our population has an IQ under 72. So it's good to keep that in mind. In the state of Oregon, you all may know there are 22,000 people with diagnosed DD. And of that 22,000 folks, we have 108 crisis beds. So what we do is provide residential care through 23 group homes up and down I-5, primarily the Portland area down to the Eugene-Springfield area along I-5, 108 beds to folks who are in need of a crisis bed. We are established under the 24-hour residential license, so our beds are, our homes are all 4- and 5-person beds, staffed at levels 24/7, 24 hours, 7 days a week operations. The 5-person beds have about 29 folks staffed in each house. The 4-person beds have about 22 folks. That is kind of give or take, but those are the staffing levels that have been established through the legislature. $93 million biennial budget, 650 employees. We are represented by primarily AFSCME. We do have a few nurses through ONA. Where we are today, the name change happened in January as a result of the changing face of our population. We are moving into an era where the folks that we're seeing are younger. They are coming with co-occurring diagnosis, primarily mental health and disabilities. 99% of them have that. 90% of our folks are with us by choice, and I say that with a little asterisk. That means 10% have been deemed through the court system to live with us. 90% are there by choice. About 25 of our folks have civil commitments, which means we are their guardian. But for the most part, the folks in our houses are there because this is the place they need to be for now. Our goal with stabilization and crisis focus is really to bring people in when they are at the most severe point in their life in a crisis, acting out, blowing out of resources that the community heretofore has been able to provide. Our goal is that we stabilize them and move them back into community. So in alignment with the mission of DHS, what we're trying to do is provide the best quality of life that these folks can have with those disabilities that they present to us. Three of our homes are medical homes. So we're serving the medically fragile population who have DD. Those are all three are up in the Portland area. They happen to be a triplex, so it's kind of one big home with three units. The other 20 of our homes are serving behavioral folks. Of those 20 behavioral homes, 12 of them have magnetic locks or are mag locked. I can go into why they're magnetic locked. I won't spend your time with that today. I'm happy to answer any other questions, but I think that sets the context of kind of who we are as an agency and a little bit about where we're going, some of the changes that we've come from. Did I miss anything, Brad?
No, Jenna, you didn't.
Any questions now? We'll certainly stay in the audience and answer as you might need us to.
Are there any questions?
Just a quick question about community notification.
Community notification.
What are the rules around that?
In terms of notifying the community of residents moving in and out?
Oh. Right, or your presence at all in the community.
Okay.
Do you want to take that?
Sure. Notifying the community of our presence would have happened when the group homes opened. And I have actually been with
Could you introduce yourself, please?
I'm sorry. Bradley Heath, Clinical Services Manager. I've been with the agency in a different capacity. I've been with the agency since its inception, and so each one of the group homes, as they rolled out into the community, there was a community notification process, a siting process where neighbors were notified. So in all cases, the neighbors are aware of what our function is.
Follow-up question?
Sure.
Okay, and as your function has changed over time because of changes in the Oregon State Hospital and others, is there any additional notification that happens?
Not directly, Representative. Mm-hmm. Our population churns, for lack of a better word. I mean, there is turnover. Mm-hmm. There isn't a lot of turnover. I would expect there will become more turnover as we focus really on a stabilization and crisis role instead of kind of a lifetime placement. We have good neighbor agreements with some of the homes. I don't know if we have them with all. I'm aware of some of them in the communities we're in. We do our best to be responsive if issues come up with our neighbors, but a lot of the properties are in their residential homes and residential settings. They're well fenced. We work as much as we can on with our own staff to make sure that we are presenting good neighbors ourselves. Mm-hmm. When situations come up, and we did have one last month where there was some damage to a neighboring home, we are right there with our leadership team to support those homes in getting restitution for damages that they've had to their garages and that kind of thing. So beyond that, I'm not aware of, and again, that may be my my tenure may not be able to inform this answer better, but we know we're guests in communities, and along with that, we also know we're part of a community, and part of our commitment is always to maintain positive relationships, both as a neighbor and as we take our clients into the community with, you know, supporting one of our goals to bring the opportunity of a more expansive life to these folks.
Representative Thompson.
In talking with constituents of mine that are care workers, it seems to me that listening to their stories, this is a population that's becoming increasingly more violent than they were in the inception of this program. How would you characterize that?
I think that is I think that's a fair assessment. I like to remind us that there are 108 beds, and we are receiving some clients that are coming with more aggressive behavior. I think that is multifold as to why that's happening. When this program was established 25 years ago, you were taking a population out of an institution and putting them into group homes, but their training, be it as it was from an institution. We're now getting younger clients who have not been institutionalized, so that mentality doesn't exist. They come sometimes knowing their rights better than I know their rights. They come knowing their patterns of behavior and what they've been able to get. So we've had to engage in different conversations around both our leadership and training with our employees. One of the things that, you know, we are bound by because of our license is the use of organ intervention systems, or OIS, as the tools that we use to intercede in behaviors. And so we train a lot, we work a lot on teaching folks how to de-escalate behaviors. We teach them how to use the proper techniques to put people in a hold, but we are not able to throw people to the floor and put them in a prone position. We're not able to put handcuffs on them because it would be a violation of their civil rights. So we are using the tools that we have at our disposal. Brad sits on the statewide steering committee for OIS, so he every month is looking at the systems issues that are presenting themselves, not just at SACU, but across the system with this population, and always considering new tools that need to be in that toolbox. But we are aware that there is there are more aggressive clients, and part of that representative is a result of they're coming to us with both mental health issues as much as DD issues. So, and that's just the population. And if I had to sit up here and speculate, I would suggest that that trend is probably going to continue. You know, will it be 10 of our 108 beds? I don't know. Will it be 100 of our 108 beds? Probably not. But we are continuing to try and work with our community partners to find placements for these folks. I think that's possible, but it's a conversation that hasn't been had yet. So I think it's a necessary conversation.
Sure.
Is there any consideration? I'm asking this from a legislative standpoint because I think we have a very big problem. Is there any consideration of changing the model, doing something different? I mean, I understand we have the homes and we keep putting people in the homes. And is that a model that we need to be looking at, saying we need something totally different? And I ask the question from the standpoint of, I understand the civil rights of patients and whatnot, but I'm also looking at workers that are being badly injured. Mm-hmm. And if this continues, there's going to be a death. Mm-hmm. And somewhere along the line, you know, the state's picking up increased liability for this. And my fear is that we're continuing to march along with a newer, different clientele in an old model, mm-hmm. and it's just, you know, getting deeper into the weeds. And maybe we needed something totally different. Is there any discussion of anything like that? Or?
Well, I think the discussion is already happening simply by the fact that we've changed our name. And, you know, the program...
Good start.
Yeah, the program didn't change on January 2nd. I think on January 3rd, we finally called the program where it's been growing to in the last few years. So I think the name change alone is acknowledgement of the changing population and needing to do some things differently. Is it a complete model overhaul? I doubt it. Are there elements that need to be improved? Absolutely there are. One of the elements that, you know, just last month we've gotten more resource, a staff reassigned from DHS into our program is a clear focus on step down, which is the process of taking someone from our program and putting them back into the community. I mentioned that's our job now, stabilization and crisis and placement back in the community, but we had no staff allocated to do that because we were just working the homes. So Aaron Kelly Seal has given us the approval to move an employee that was doing this kind of in another arena, specifically directed full-time into our program. So the smaller model modifications are happening to be able to support the direction I know we need to go. Complete model overhaul, not something we're looking at, might be necessary. I am in the process right now of developing an RFP that we've asked the labor group to participate with us in, looking at finding an external resource to come in and say, this is what we need to do for employee safety and client safety. This is what is being done on a national level. So tomorrow I'm presenting that draft of an RFP to the labor management team. So I think everyone's acknowledging that we need to look at some different elements of the model. I don't think we need to take the entire erector set apart, but I think maybe we need to move some of the pieces.
Let's move on to. You want to follow up? You want to ask after? You want to Thank you very much.
Thank you very
you
much.
We will stay around in case you have other questions.
Will do.
Let me call. Who do we have next?
Ralph
Groner
and Randy.
Ralph Groner? I remember him. And Randy Riddenbush, please. And you have some other folks that you're going to be introducing.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you so very much. My name for the record is Ralph Groner. I work for Oregon Ask Me, Council 75. This is my 25th year, and in those 25 years, I've been assigned the state op group homes, now called, we call them SACU, Stabilization and Crisis Units, and you'll hear from my members, so I won't be spending much time at all because we have three members who might tell you a better story here today than myself, DHS, or Randy. So I only say that I've watched it grown. from, I hate to use that word, grown, but grow, from a very small program that took the worst case client, supposedly, out of Fairview. And to today, it's a totally different picture. And with that, I would hope you could hear my three members who are here to teach you or talk to you about what that picture really is out in the field. At this point, I'll introduce Randy Ritterbusch, who is our director, our staff rep of our Stabilization Crisis Unit, who also had background in corrections. He also used to represent the State Hospital and the Oregon Youth Authority also. All four are involved with the thinking of how this works. So he's here today to talk to you and introduce our members.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Just for the record, real quick, do you know of anybody who tells stories better than Ralph Groner?
There may be some that are tied, but there ain't anybody that's any better.
So I was wondering when he said they could tell a better story, and I've yet to see that, so I might be impressed today.
That's why we're going to the direct testimony, because once Ralph gets a hold of the story and changes it, it might not be what the employees will tell us.
Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee, my name is Randy Ritterbusch, and as Ralph's told you, I have the privilege of representing the members that work at SACU. But during my career, I want to start out before I introduce them. As Ralph mentioned, I did work in corrections. I worked in corrections as an employee working in a kitchen for almost 10 years. And when I first went there and they shut that door behind me that first day, I thought, oh my goodness, what have I got myself into? But about 2 or 3 weeks later, I found myself in the kitchen slamming the door and smiling at my workers, the inmates, and said, that's to remind you where you are. I was joking, you know. But then I went to the state hospital. And I didn't think the hair on the back of my neck could stand up anymore. I couldn't tell the difference between the staff, the clients. I got locked into the they call it the nurse's bubble when the client started acting out. Staff rushed in. They helped them. They got the situation under control, and we went on our merry way. The old hospital was scary, but when I had the privilege of taking tours of these homes, I don't have any hair left on the back of my neck, folks. Somebody please come into these homes and see how these folks are living. And it's not anybody's fault. See, you know, society has spent years ignoring the mentally ill. And now finally we're doing something about it. And we need to take this program just one step further. I would agree with Jana, maybe we don't need a complete overhaul, but we have to figure out proper placements for these folks. So as my members speak, that's really what we're looking for. Is how do we make folks safe, the communities, the clients, and the staff? We're going to talk a lot about my members, because that's what I'm here about. But when I speak again, I'm going to be talking about the clients, because they're just as important, and they're the ones that we're supposed to be protecting. So with that, Trina, Gordon, Matt, would you guys come up?
You know, for some of you folks, this is a first-time experience. But
oh, yes, it is.
A few of you have seen me a few times, so we're on a face-to-face basis.
We really appreciate you coming to talk to us.
Thank you for having us again.
The first member that's going to speak is Trina Brink. Trina Brink is a vocational behavior specialist. She assists in writing the behavioral plans, which she's going to discuss and talk to you about what happens when we don't have enough staff. Jana talked to you today about the staffing levels. What you're going to hear is that we base our behavioral plans on the staffing levels. We base the care of the individuals on how much money you give us, not on how much they need or what they need to get better or what we need to protect the community.
Hi, Mr. Chair. My name is Katrina Brink and the rest of the committee. It's nice to see some familiar faces here. This is my first time, so excuse my anxiety. But Jana did give you an overview of the current status of the group homes up and down the valley. It's the last, you know, option for a lot of these people that we serve. But and they come from all places, OIA, corrections, COME, all this stuff. But these clients, when they come into our program, receive a behavior support plan. And so it's like we know that we can't staff for the what-ifs, but we got to prepare for the what is likely. And in the what is likely, you know, we'll get their history, their problems, and what the worst thing in a crisis would normally look like. And that has the OIS techniques. And that does, you know, and some of those techniques require five people. And sometimes that is the five or six people that are on the shift. It takes everybody. And at that point, some of the other, you know, the other staff, there might be one staff who's watching the rest of them, or some of them during the emergency might even be unattended. We have the opportunity to call neighboring homes for backup. We can call 911. We can even, you know, just say in some case scenario, we had a crisis team that could come by. But they are not there immediately. You know, there's no immediate response. But I just lost my train of thought.
Take a deep breath. Relax. The only person who bites up here is Alyssa Kinney Guy.
She doesn't look mean, but the rest of us will protect you.
She's familiar.
He knows that, right?
Yes.
Very well.
So it's like even if the police did show up, what are they going to do? It's like, it's, you know, 10% of our population is the most violent and the most and does the most property destruction in these homes. It's senseless to think that we're going to arrest them and put them in a prison. I mean, they can't be adjudicated. They can't aid in the defense. You know, they can come and give them shots and sedate them so they're calm for a while. But that's just, you know, it's a more costly system and it's a waste of more resources. And it's like, you know, ideally, you know, I think our agency needs more supports and more freedom that you guys can maybe help with. It's like, if we can get the waivers to give the PRNs, you know, psychotropic sedates, so we're not having to wait and traumatize these individuals further by dealing with law enforcement and everything else. So during these incidences, I'm quite familiar with a few individuals who they falsely report some abuse or whatever. So we have the oversight of a WAPI. And so they check to make sure that we do everything correct.
Sorry, oversight.
They check our... We have...
What's the name?
Okay, let's see if I can pronounce this without getting tongue-tied. Office of Adult and Abuse and Prevention Invest... Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigation.
Thanks.
They deal with the neglect and abuse charges.
Right.
And so in these BSPs, it'll give us the staffing guidelines. So if you don't follow them to the T, a WAPI can say, okay, you've done neglect. You did not keep constant supervision. And you've turned your head. You went and got the client a meal. You did this. You did that. And you didn't keep it constant. So we're going to give you a neglect charge. Our agency doesn't have to keep you as an employee. So now you're discharged from the state. You cannot be employed in any of the private sectors who give you $10 an hour. So you're pretty much unemployable. You go on unemployment, and maybe you're lucky if Walmart will hire you. Mm. So it's like, you know, one thing that you can't even meet up can destroy your career. And for a lot of our staff, this is their careers to take care of these individuals. So... You'll hear about, you know, and some of you already have knowledge of all the injuries, you know, $500,000 to $1 million of safe claims a year, mostly lost time, some surgeries, and you'll see the photos. And it's like, it's unsustainable. And it's just nonsense because we would like to use that money to support our staff, have more group homes that, you know, that were the ones that got closed, because we know we're needed. There's no other placement that's appropriate for all these individuals. So, you know, as Brad mentioned, 10% of the SECU clients are under the guidance of PSRB and parole and probation. If these, you know, one of the suggestions I got from my coworkers is that if they do the same crime that would have gotten them supervised by them and they're under our care at the time, why can't PSRB come in? Why can't we have the extra support from these other groups? Because they can put the restrictions on the clients that we cannot. You know, it's like if you end up going to the hospital because a client punches you and tries to choke you on Monday, do you feel comfortable on Friday going to the movies alone with them because you don't want to infringe on the rights to access the community? But the PSRB and parole and probation can. And nor should we. You know, it's a slippery slope. You know, we also, you know, would like to have, you know, better communication when these clients do step down. There's no, you know, the same... Our clients aren't broken. We cannot fix them. We can't cure them. they have the same difficulties, and we have give the most supports out of all of the all the agencies to support the IDD population. We should have better communication supports that we can transfer back to them and go back and forth, so they don't, you know, bust out of a private program, hurt more individuals, and have to go through OIA, corrections, state hospital, and try to see, you know, because we don't have the beds for them to come back into. It's more costly and, quite frankly, a waste of time, and these clients come back even more traumatized. You know, seeing some of these crises in these homes traumatizes the other roommates. They come now with, you know, rather than from being in the institution, now that they come from, you know, some of them have pretty horrific backgrounds of various levels of abuse. So it's kind of like the PTSD comes back when they have to see somebody, you know, get injured, screaming, crying, whatever's going on.
I'm going to ask you to wrap up if you can.
Okay, thank you. But basically,
doing great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But yes, our staff know these clients. They give the this population the best quality care they can. But let's stop treating them like disposable cogs and kick them to the curb and not give a crap. Excuse my language. But let's appreciate them, because every time they get injured and they can't work for us anymore, we're losing all their knowledge and skills. Thank you.
Thanks, Trina. Next, I'd like to introduce Gordon. He is also a vocational behavioral specialist, and he's going to talk to you a little bit about the placement of the homes and the response time as proximity to police, fire, and schoolyards and other public entities.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As Jenna has stated, our program has changed.
Please introduce yourself.
My name is Gordon Lorsung.
Thank you.
I'm a vocational specialist at Aston Group Home of the Stabilization and Crisis Unit. As Jenna has stated, our program has changed from the state-operated program to the Stabilization and Crisis Unit to reflect what we're actually doing these days. Our agency tells the legislature and the community and its employees and all stakeholders that our program is the safety net for the community. And if that is so, as we do ensure the safety of the individuals we serve, as well as the community, we should be designated as public safety personnel. Our program started in 1990, and we served individuals that have intellectual as well as developmental disabilities, and that came out of the Fairview training, as Jenna has stated. And most of those individuals have moved on to private group or foster homes. A number of them are still set. The individuals that we're getting now are being transferred a lot from corrections, jail, prison, Oregon Youth Authority, coming with stipulations with parole, probation, and PSRB. This is kind of going in line with the federal government's push to reduce recidivism rate in the corrections departments by reducing individuals with mental illness, such as antipersonality disorder, bipolar disorder, returning into the corrections arena. By offering them the opportunity to go into a community treatment facility, they are able to get out of jail and get additional treatment for the issues that they have. This is also falls in lines with the governor's budget and the big savings he's making on corrections to funnel these individuals into the community group homes. Our homes are placed in mostly dense residential areas, as well as some community outlying areas. In the pamphlets that you received, there's a number of pictures of the homes. The first picture is of the Brooks home and the nearest emergency and police response locations. And it's about 10 to 15 minutes at the minimum to respond to the Brooks home. The next picture is of the Cade home, and as you can see, that home is directly inside a very dense residential area. And the next picture shows the close proximity of all schools to that Cade location. And if you go on to the next one, we're talking about McClay home, which is a little bit in a little more rural setting, but still in a kind of a residential area. The next picture shows the emergency and fire location. So that, again, there's a large response time for that location. The next picture we have talks about the Madison and Hawthorne homes in Portland. These are side-by-side homes located in a very tight residential area, close to school, close to the freeway, close to many community areas. And the next picture does show the close proximity of the police and fire departments to that location. If you go to the, go skip to that page, the next page, and go to the Turner overview, that particular home is located in Turner, and the emergency response time to that location is about 20 to 30 minutes. That means that our staff are going to have to deal with that individual or that situation for about 20 to 30 minutes before they get any kind of support. The individuals have been, as Trina's outlined, they've been identified as intellectually disabled and able to unable to aid and assist in their defense. The neighbors of these homes are placed in these neighborhoods. There are informational meetings when the homes are opened up. The neighbors do not have the right to know any specifics about any of the individuals that are placed in these locations due to federal confidentiality regulations. They know it's a group home, even if they're sexual offenders. Our program is designed with a typical intellectual developmental individual disability individual in mind. The individuals that we got coming into the program now are not that type of individuals. They're coming in with criminal experience and mentality. They're coming in with street and good street fighting skills. They're used to a punitive system that involves consequences, which we cannot apply. And due to the intense nature of these individuals, our program is one of the few that can even provide services for these individuals. The state hospital won't even take our individuals anymore. The staff that work in this program do it because they want to help people, and they continue to stay there because they have this deep desire to do that. But they're susceptible to injury and assault based upon the constraints of the OIS and the rights that these individuals are protected by. Our program's injury rate is higher than even police and fire. Again, I believe that we deserve the public safety designation. I would like to tell you briefly about an incident that occurred approximately 3 weeks ago. We had an individual in a public Portland school. The individual proceeded to alert from the school district. The school called us. We sent response, three people. We received another call. The vehicle was needed additional support, so we sent another team. Received a third call. The original van had gotten damaged in the process, so I responded in another secured vehicle. Upon receiving there was one police officer on hand. A second got there as I pulled in. As I was directed over to where the individual was hidden up, a third officer showed up. We discussed the situation with the police officer briefly. He said, well, if you want the individual off his property, you're going to have to take him off, even though the property manager was telling them that she wanted that individual off the property. The individual was barricaded behind a dense bamboo jungle that was only accessed from the sides. We approached him from the sides. Prior to this, the police officer said that it is not their jurisdiction, it is ours. We showed the parole probation documentation. The police officer informed us, well, they're not in our custody, they're in your custody. You are the professionals, we're here to back you up. So we then proceeded to go in on the sides, use OIS-approved techniques. They were somewhat effective. We ended up getting the individual out of the bamboo jungle. She was trying to use bamboo spears to stab the staff. We got those away from her. Once we were out of that area, the police said, okay, there's your time. You need to cuff her. And we said, of course, well, we cannot do that. We don't have cuffs. We're not allowed to do that. So at that point, the officer noticed that I had a number of lacerations. I was bleeding from the face and head. My picture is up over there, as a matter of fact. At that point, they stepped in. They secured her with handcuffs. picked her up and moved her over towards our secured vehicle, put them in. They proceeded to try and kick the window and the door out, so then the police pulled them back out, set them in the middle of the parking lot where we waited for emergency personnel to arrive. At that time, a discussion was made as to whether we could give a sedate and where she would go after that. The decision was finally that the police made. They wanted a sedate. The individual was transferred to a psych ward for observation due to the sedate because he couldn't go back to the home. He needed to have RN supervision until he came out. And later on that night, the individual was returned back to the house.
Thanks, Gordon. I know we're getting lengthy, and I appreciate your time very much, so we're going to try to keep this a little briefer. But the next person is Matt. He's the president of the local, so he's going to talk about the staff injuries that are occurring.
Hi, my name is Matt Orser. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and Committee. A few of you have already met with me before. We've had great discussions over what I'm going to be talking to you about today, but I'm going to make it real brief being for the time. As you see over here on the board, first of all, 1246, I want you to recognize something really quick. This little blue piece of tape, which you are going to see on my members behind you, represents all the injuries that have happened. So if you'd all please stand up to have a piece to them. These happen on a daily, 24/7, a week problem. This is where we're at with this. These are the injuries that I wanted to show a few of you. I had this great little speech I wanted to give you guys, but I'm gonna wing it today due to the time. Okay. So, injury up in the top left corner, that is a bite. We go through bites quite often. We understand that. If you see the second picture, that is a bite where the actual individual swallowed the flesh of one of our staff. The finger that you presently see with the Band-Aid on it, that was a bite that went all the way through the bone to the bone. So it's caused nerve damage to the finger. The injury on the right is a kick to the ribs, which actually came out with broken ribs. To be exact, the injured suffered due to broken ribs, and that was the broken rib part. We get down to the face. Here's our horror story. I know this doesn't happen all the time, but this is an individual that we were talking about when you heard Jenna talk about placement and things we're trying to work on within the agency. This is some of that training, that OIS that I've talked to you all about before, the organ intervention system. Yes, that works for the stabilization part. Okay, great. Crisis part, not so great. You've heard Jenna say to you guys today, and Brad, both of them sat right up here and said, we need better tools. We need more staff. If we had the tools and the staff, we wouldn't be getting the injuries here that you're seeing up here on this board that people go through on a daily basis. The jaw at the bottom, that is from an individual who swung, Lord knows why they have this anyway, an aluminum bottle full of water as a weapon, swung and broke that jaw. The teeth now, since they've had the plates put in there, are falling out. This person's losing a great grill that they had that was natural. Because we don't have the tools or the training that we need for the crisis response, these are the injuries that you're seeing. Another thing is, I know this is funny, and I know you're going to probably laugh at this one, but I want to show you guys something. This is a spit mask, okay? And in our agency, spit masks, unlike DOC in New Oregon State Hospital, get to apply to their individual that is spitting. This is what we get to do when they're spitting. Now, does that look safe to you at all?
This is what our staff
have to put on. This is not safe. This should go on the individual spitting on us, not for us to have to protect ourselves or anything in that way. And that's why we showed this, and we've discussed that on that. I guess in my closing
statement. I don't think anybody's laughing about that.
No, I would hope not.
No, it's
okay, misspoken out of that. My apologies. It wasn't about you.
Taking seriously what you're saying. I just wanted to make that.
And I understand that, sir. Where I really want to go with this, if we had the staffing and we had the tools to protect these individuals. So now flip my board around, please. This is HEPA. Okay? I can't tell you, because of the HIPAA laws, what's going on with our agents or our clients that we can't serve correctly due to those injuries. I'd love to sit here and show pictures of the damage that have happened to our individuals. I can't do that. It's protected under HIPAA. So if we're not getting this adequate stuff that we need, imagine what's going on with our clients, who we are all here in this room today to show you a passion of our job. We love our job. We love doing what we do. But in my final point, there's no reason for us to go to work, our children see us leave before we go to work, and we come home and look like this. It causes post-traumatic stress at home also with our children. It's a proven fact. We've got more EAP being called for our children for counseling due to this stuff happening at the job that shouldn't be happening at all. And it's just something that we would like to go along, and we hope that our committee that we've all been talking about, that we can get this resolved and move forward. We're stuck in the 20th century. We need to get with the 21st century. Our training's behind. I know Brad sits on the OICE Oversight Steering Committee. I've been asked to sit in on that once, and he's only one vote, along with another person. That's two votes out of their whole table. That's not going to get change. That's why we're coming to you. Hopefully you guys can put that pressure up there. Ask the questions that you need to ask. Why is this stuff not being changed? Why are we still stuck behind when we need to be moving forward with the individuals? And they are coming with us a lot smarter. They may be labeled IDD or DD, but they grew up on the street, a lot of them. They know how to fight. But take a look at the members back here. Do you think these people grew up on the street and know how to fight like they do? No. And that's where that training comes along we really need, and the staffing. Thank you for hearing me.
Thank you very much.
So to wrap it up a little bit, Matt talked a little bit about the other clients. Jana, I think, described the clientele very well from what I've seen. And they know it better than me. I haven't been with them that long. But each one of our homes have about one or one and a half of these clients now that are disrupting the homes on a regular basis. There's one home where the client, who is stable, he's going to be like this forever. He's autistic. The program has done a fairly good job with him, but he has a roommate on his side of the house. And whenever that roommate or anything irritates the other gentleman, he points to point you out, and he's done this to me. And you leave right now, or the man goes into a behavior. So this other gentleman who has his own behaviors gets escorted out of his room and ran out of the house to the other side of the house because his roommate is so violent. Now, he accepts being moved, but it puts him into behaviors on the other side of the house, too. It's just the whole system is not working. And it is really, as Jana and I commented, it's about placement. It's about finding the right place for these folks. And that's why, you know, Ralph and I and our members have worked really hard talking to legislatures of both the House, the Senate, both Republican and Democrats, trying to get a committee to work hard together, to take a work group, a legislative work group, to take a hard look at the program. We're not fighting with the agency. As a matter of fact, Jana and I try to work very good together, and we've both made a great effort to bring both labor and the management together. But we can't do it without your help. We can't fix abuse, neglect laws. We can't fix staffing levels. We can't have a woman go out in the community with a client, a male client, and tell her you're one-on-one and you have to be 5 feet away from this person, no more than that, and stay visual for 8 hours. When does that lady go to the bathroom? What happens when she has to go to the bathroom? She sneaks in for a minute, goes to the bathroom, the client's outside, and somebody sees them and turns her in. She loses her job and her ability to work with this clientele for the rest of her life in the state of Oregon. That's not abuse. That's not neglect. That's somebody having to go to the bathroom. We need to take a hard, long look at this program and move it forward. We need to move it forward. That's all we're asking. Our staff and the people that work there and the people that live there deserve a right to get better and to go home at night. Right. So we don't have the answers. We just want your help.
Thank you very much for being your group. Thank you all for being brave and testifying. I know it's a challenging experience. We'll be talking to others of our colleagues and see where we're going in this area. And it was we really appreciate you guys coming and telling us your story. We'll see if we can find some way to help.
Can I just say one thing, Mr. Chair?
Very briefly, yes.
Okay, yeah. Just want to thank you also because you gave me a demonstration along with some other legislators on October 9th. I still remember that day very well. And then you came kind of, I put up a good fight, I think, right?
Yes, yes.
As I've earned my reputation from over here. I was in a different committee with you in January where we had a hearing. I don't know if it was Human Services or Consumer Protection, but, you know, clearly more needs to change than just the name. That's a start, and it looks like there are some changes that are happening, but in terms of a very different population, you know, it's a broader than just DHS and the employees. It's, you know, housing. I'm on the housing committee, and we constantly talk about how there's not enough housing and mental health resources for people as they step up or down. So I think the broader conversation is really important, and, you know, we're trying to look at what's best for the 10% that might be causing the problem, the 90% in there that are trying to get better and step down, and we may be continually re-traumatizing the employees, the community, and the neighborhood that's, you know, that is have these homes. Two of them are in my district, in fact. And so I think it's great. You've made an incredible impression in three different visits with legislators, and I really welcome this conversation. I see some of you that, you know, that you were also part of that October hearing. So thank you for really bringing this to our attention. And it seems like I love that there's a great relationship with DHS. I think there's a lot of potential here, and I'm really eager to see that move forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Representative Thompson, you want to wrap it up?
Well, I want to thank all of you for coming. I've met with many of you on this issue over the past couple of months. I'm very, very concerned about what we're doing here because I can tell you if legislators were being treated as badly as the staff in these homes are being treated, and I'm sure that people out there would love to do that to us, we would be doing a whole lot about it. So I don't accept the argument that there's nothing we can do. We don't have any options but to do something. The other big concern I have in talking to employees that didn't really come out today is there is massive damage going on in these facilities where individuals are getting out of control and literally doing $60,000, $70,000 worth of damage to the building and fixtures. I don't know where the money comes from, but I don't have any budgets anywhere that can endure that kind of thing. So we're going to have to get very creative on how to do this. The other issue I think we have to look at is it appropriate to have these individuals in the communities that they're in? Because one of these days, somebody's going to get away from their caretaker, and how much danger is that creating to children and families in the immediate community? And this may not be the model that we should be looking at for this population. I understand the problems with mental illness and disability, and also understand under the Affordable Care Act, we're now pushing this more and more into health care. But we got to do it right. And what I'm seeing is a giant Band-Aid that really isn't designed well, and we're trying to just make something happen without any real clear thought pattern. So I think we have to address this somewhere.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you. I'll close the informational hearing on stabilization and crisis units and open an informational hearing on telemedicine next steps. This is a response to Senate Bill 1560, which did not get across the Senate. And we'll start with Kathy Britton and Kyle Gorman, perhaps, and then follow that up. I'm sorry?
No, the three of them, and Dave Sanders.
And Dave Sanders in the same unit?
Yes.
Okay.
And then Tom Holt.
And Dave, why don't you join us as well? And then we'll have Tom Holt, who can lead his own as a rebuttal to anything you guys say.
I'm not sure. We've been arguing that DHS thing with Carolyn, and it's more.
Maybe she can sign it. But if you can toss it, and I might do that again.
Go.
Okay. Hi. For the record, my name is Kathy Britton.
Hold on a moment. Hold on.
Oh, sorry.
Yes.
She could start.
Yeah, I wanted to let settle things so we can hear what you're saying.
Can you hold one second? Because Jim Thompson.
I'm sorry?
I'd love to go out and just connect.
Okay, go on.
Can you just take 1 minute?
All right, we'll stand at ease for 1 minute. Let's try and hold it to five.
No, one.
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 Because you wanted to, you said you had to leave it.
This is Kathy Britton, and I am the Program Director for the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon. I have been tasked with providing you some information about telemedicine in Oregon and why we came to Senate Bill 1560. I will not read you this history. I'm sure you're capable of reading it all yourself. I did want to point out a couple of things. First of all, telemedicine is not new to the state. It started in 1993 with a project called RodeoNet, which was a grant from the Office of Rural Health Policy to provide mental health services to folks in Eastern Oregon using what was then satellite-based telecommunications. So I ran that program, so at the risk of telling you disclosing my age, you'll know I've been around for a while. We have come a long way since then. Telemedicine went through a real drought in the 90s once the grant money went away, and we were looking at a lot of expensive equipment. We were looking at a lack of telecommunications. We were looking at all kinds of policy barriers, and it just ground on slowly until just recently, 2005, began kind of a resurgence of telemedicine. And we realized that one of the biggest barriers that there was to providing telemedicine was the lack of reimbursement. We couldn't expect good physicians here to provide telemedicine without reimbursement. They needed to get paid for what they did. At the request of the chair of the Health and Human Services Committee, Senator Monta Sanderson, created a work group to put together a bill that would provide for some basic reimbursement of telemedicine within institutional walls. So hospitals, clinics, places that were considered standard healthcare institutions. At that time, we didn't anticipate that we would be moving along quite so rapidly into the situation that we're looking at now, where a lot of healthcare is beginning to occur outside of those institutional walls. There are several things that are driving that. For example, our patients are driving that. They need to be able to get health care, particularly for urgent care problems and for primary care services, quickly, and not have to lose time from work, not have to pack up a baby at 11 o'clock at night and truck him 30 minutes to... That sounds awful. I didn't mean that, but any disrespect to the baby. But and take him to an emergency room where you then sit for another couple of hours waiting for that child to get cared for. We need kids who are presenting with symptoms in schools to be able to be cared for quickly so that if those symptoms are contagious, they're not passed along to all 24 other children in their classes. People want health care where they are and not have to look at going to some specific place to get that care. So our patients are driving it. Our equipment is driving it. We have equipment now that will allow us to be placed on an individual, and we can gather all kinds of data about a chronic disease, send that back to the person's physician, and be able to intervene at a point where they are not acute, and we can get them the care that they need before they have to be admitted to a hospital or some other sort of facility. We're also finding that our change in our healthcare system is driving this, and it's exciting because it's an opportunity to look at how we can manage the cost of healthcare using the technology that we've worked so hard to develop and provide care to patients in a cost-effective manner, and to also provide care to more patients that we weren't able to reach because they just simply had no way of accessing that care. The bill that passed in 2009, like I said, covered institutional telemedicine. It really did not even conceive of the fact that we would need to strengthen that statute to provide reimbursement for people who are going to be providing care in those non-traditional settings. We are now behind the curve again because care in non-institutional settings is going on, and it's going on throughout the world. It's going on in many large centers in the United States, and we need to be able to encourage that development in a responsible manner, but also to pay for it as it's being developed. We believe that the bill that was introduced, not by Tao, but a bill that we were able to support, was really good telemedicine policy. It did several things. First of all, it provided telemedicine reimbursement to all types of services, regardless. There was no requirement for origination site, and many of you who are familiar with CMS know that they specify very specifically the origination sites that must be used in order to be reimbursed for telemedicine. It increases access to service for patients, again, from their homes and their schools and workplaces, a care that might not otherwise be sought until it reaches the acute stage, at which point it's much more costly to pay for, and the chance of spreading whatever it is that person might have is increased. It reduces the cost of care. Some people said, well, the bill requested parity for service, and I don't know whether it was the language that was confusing or there was a misperception, but we're asking not for parity. We're asking for reasonable payment for what the cost of the service was. And that service is less costly to provide than if that patient goes to an emergency room or if he goes to an urgent care center. So rather than being the same cost, it's actually reducing the cost overall. It'll free up emergency
rooms. Are you talking about cost or price in this case?
The cost of delivering the care and the cost for reimbursing it. When we do a visit to a home, that service is about 80% of what it would cost to provide that service in an urgent care clinic or in an emergency room. So
the cost is less or the price is less?
The cost is less and the price is less.
So a doctor spending 10 minutes on a phone costs less than a doctor spending 10 minutes in the office?
A doctor spending 10 minutes in a video conference costs less than the physician services doesn't cost less, but the surrounding support services do cost less. Does that make sense? David can probably explain that better when he
talks. I understand price and cost is not being the same thing. I was just checking.
I'll address that.
Thank you. Yeah. I appreciate that. The other thing is, if we're not presenting contagious or infectious illnesses in emergency rooms and urgent care clinics, we're not spreading them. And I know many of us have gone into urgent care and had to sit down amongst a group of people, and just you can kind of just feel yourself getting sick by what's being presented there. We can better treat chronic conditions with this kind of service to the home. So we can manage those services better, we can reduce the amount of acute care that's required, and we can keep the cost down for hospitals who have to treat them when the situation becomes acute. We can also assist hospitals to develop service lines that replace some of the institutionally based service lines that they're losing now as a result of the changes in healthcare. And
I need to do a time check this during, sir. How long do you?
I can back off from this.
Planning on 20 minutes total, so You've used up about 10 of that.
Okay, far. Let me back off from this and give this to David, and then I'll come back and close. Okay, thank you.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. I'm Dave Sanders. I'm Zoom Cures co-founder and CEO of an Oregon physician. Back up. Chair Greenlick, when I first appeared here a number of years ago, my sons were in the audience, and you admonished the speakers to be succinct and powerful. And you, sort of unbeknownst to yourself, you probably defined a generation of Zoom Cure dinner table discussion rules. So I'll try to follow through on that right here, given the time we have left. Okay, so I'm going to try to do three things here in a few minutes. First, I will try to give you some brief policy background. Kathy has largely already addressed that. I'll focus on the key elements of the bill, and then I'll primarily focus on the key objections we encountered in the Senate side. And then Kyle Gorman will discuss some real-life experiences with telecare in the field. So first, this is a phenomenal time to be in healthcare. This is just a wonderful time because now it's a turn for delivery system to show that we can deliver twice half 10, twice the health at half the price and 10 times the customer delight. And that's a challenge for us. And to do that, to do twice half 10, we must deploy telecare. Telecare is a vital vehicle to get to twice half 10. Here's why. Look, four of the most important elements to get there are to improve chronic care management, chronic disease management, to improve access to preventive services, to decrease hospital readmissions, and to decrease ER utilization. All four of those things are contingent upon a close integration of in-person services, I'd argue, and telecare services. For each of those four things, because of time, I won't elaborate here. I can come back to it later in questions, how you actually would do those things. And yet, we cannot today, in the current paradigm, tap telecare to do those things. So, given that, 3 years ago, Zoom Care went before the Oregon Medical Board and outlined a way to begin to provide primary care services in Oregon. The Medical Board and us outlined a model. For the last 3 years, we've been offering telecare on a self-pay basis, because the insurers refuse to pay for those services. But the good news is we've researched that our care for the last 3 years and are publishing a paper with OHSU jointly demonstrating the efficacy and safety of primary care. In fact, we're going to meet the medical board in April showing them those results. So given that, and given the insurers a refusal to cover those services, again, true primary care services, we work with others, telehealth and others, to create SB 1560. And SB 1560 really did two basic things, as Kathy said. It removed the restriction on both the patient and doctor both being in a hospital, essentially, to be paid, and it also removed the restriction that forbid reimbursement or didn't compel reimbursement unless service wasn't available otherwise in person. By doing those two things, we do create a dynamic and competitive marketplace that will drive down costs and increase access to healthcare in this marketplace. The principle is the care is the care, the visit's the visit, whether in face-to-face or face-to-screen. It's a very simple principle that guides this bill. And yet we faced a number of objections. I think three come to mind, and one I want to focus on, Chair Greenlick. But the first was the charge that this caused or created parity between in-person care and telecare. That's just That isn't the case. In fact, what the bill would call for is it would require providers to use a GT modifier, which is a telecare modifier. This is a well-known practice in American medicine. And what the insurers would say, every time you use the modifier, that's a discount from the in-person price. It's a well-known practice for how you use modifiers to gain contractual discounts. So it would not at all require price parity. The second charge was that it would increase the overall cost of care. This was the same argument that was made about mental health services and wellness services. And, of course, it's not true. It does add a new unit of care that wasn't previously paid for, in theory. But really, it expands access to primary care and also decreases the unit cost of care because, in fact, insurers will pay less. They will, at the price point, pay less for a comparable unit of service. The third and only real substantive objection is this, and I want to dwell here for a minute with our time on this one, and this was the objection raised that it would somehow perpetuate fee-for-service. This was the one, I think, substance objection, I think, raised by legislators on the Senate side, and I want to dwell here for a minute. It's very important to come back to the history, though, of fee-for-service and capitation or subscription-based care. So in the late 80s and early 90s, there was a powerful shift in this state from fee-for-service to prepayment of services, subscription models of care. And I was just entering practice, you know, at that time. And unfortunately, that movement sort of spectacularly cratered. It failed, and the marketplace moved back to fee-for-service, unfortunately. And the reason why was probably twofold. The providers lacked the electronic systems to manage the data, manage the patients effectively. That's probably been largely resolved, I think, by now, or at least we're on the right track. But two, they also lacked the systems to manage the risk, the actuarial risk of managing a patient population. So, weary of those experiences and that flame out, you know, a decade or so ago.
You missed the important point in that.
Go ahead,
your last
please.
Point. The inability to manage the risk was because they were being capitated for things far beyond their own control. So, yeah, I think you can't capitate an individual physician for their hospital use. That doesn't make sense, but you can capitate.
Sure, I think there were a range of models. There was primary care cap. There was various models in play at that time. And I think when we came back to it again this time, there has emerged, I believe, a conventional wisdom, which is as we move again, and we will move again right now from fee-for-service to capitation or partial capitation, what will happen is we're going to see emerging probably a four-layer payment model, at least in the near term. And it will be comprised of a fee-for-service chassis, will remain the underlying method of payment, then you will see a coordination fee to coordinate chronic disease, communication, and there will largely be a fee for performance based upon paying for ideal best practices, and lastly, what's known as gain sharing, where providers might be rewarded for reducing overall costs. But I believe you will see a more incremental model based upon the experiences from last time, weary having providers take on that risk. It's in that context that I'm very confident that this bill is well situated because it will allow providers and insurers for the first time to cover the vital remote services, telecare services, and they do that when the insurers and providers discuss payment for the first time about fee-for-service in person and remote care, they will now say this. The insurer will say, we're already paying you now for services in person and via telecare. Let's now make the move to a subscription-based fee. We've already broken that barrier. So I believe that it will evolve that way. So I think it fits in very nicely, in fact, with the current path we're on in this community towards a new model of capitation. So I'm going to close my comments there and turn it over to Kyle Gorman.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Kyle Gorman. I'm the executive officer for Clackamas Fire District Number 1, and I'm also the vice chair for the National Emergency Medical Services Advisory Council, one of 25 people in the United States that provide advice on EMS issues to the federal government. I want to talk a little bit about Clackamas Fire first. We respond to more than 16,000 medical calls every year. And we expect that of those 16,000 calls, about a third, 30% or so, will be, by anyone's definition, not an emergency. They will require services. They will require medical follow-up. They will require some intervention of some type, but they will not require, typically, a transport to the single most expensive place in the universe to receive medical care, which is a hospital emergency room. Unfortunately, the payment systems for pre-hospital care, and recognize that our world is not in institutions. It's in grocery store aisles and classrooms and houses and workplaces and so on. We never or very, very rarely respond to institutional needs. Our patients are where they happen to be at the time they require our services. So the payment model is that nobody gets paid unless the patient gets transported to the hospital. And we think that that's a very expensive and inefficient way to incentivize service. So we think that there are some opportunities for paramedics to communicate with primary care physicians or other physicians remotely, and I have in my pocket right now the technology to do that, to Skype or FaceTime with physicians, with a paramedic beside the patient, where we can feel the skin, we can take the vital signs, we can draw bloods, we can do all of the testing necessary. And for us, this is about really good decision making. It's about making the right decision every time for the patient, and not just the decision to transport them to the hospital. Now, telemedicine is really not that new to us. We've been communicating with physicians on the radio since 1974, and the nature of our service delivery, I will say, is the original Zoom care, with apologies to Dr. Sanders, small z, not capital Z, but... you know, this is telemedicine, telehealth, health IT is particularly and uniquely suited to emergency services providers, because we think that there's a tremendous amount of money to be saved in making additional decisions on the scene. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, in concert with the Center for Medicare Services, just released a study last summer that said that they believe they could save Medicare about $600 million a year if they gave additional options to field providers and allowed them to transport to something other than a hospital emergency room. We're offering yet another option through this bill, and that is to allow them to treat on the scene and relinquish the patient then to their primary care provider without having to transport to any other facility at all. So we think that there are some great advantages for the pre-hospital world, and there are some advantages for the insurance world, because it will be, we think, far less expensive to treat with this model than previous models. So that's all I have to say. Thank you very much.
I think the notion of having a first responder paramedic being able to communicate with a physician is not the same as what I think Dr. Saunders is talking about in terms of telemedicine services. Right? I mean, were they both covered in 1560?
Both would have been covered in 1560. Yes, they're ever so slightly different models. In one model, you have a healthcare provider on each end of the phone. In one model, you don't. But in the two models, you're treating different kinds of patients with different needs. And I think that's the distinction.
The far more classic models, they have two medical care providers involved. I mean, this is... Because, David, you didn't raise
I guess the fourth issue, which is the clinical service precisely the same clinically, or under what circumstances is the service, the distance medicine service, the same as a face-to-face visit?
Yes, Chairman, that is one of the most important issues, and that was the issue that we presented to the Oregon Medical Board 3 years ago. We believe that the coding system that governs American healthcare answers that question. It defines the history, physical, and test, and the encounter required to create a code. So, for example, a visit delivered solely by telephone would not meet the typical tests of, say, a 99213 code. You wouldn't be able to have the visual inspection as well as the history required to code the visit. So there wouldn't be gaming of the system. That's why I use the motto, the visit is the visit, the care is the care, whether face-to-face or face-to-screen. The coding system defines the unit of payment.
You've been living in the wrong world if you think medicine is defined by code rather than the clinical practice, David.
Well, if you ask me about reimbursement for the unit, it is defined.
I'm not asking about reimbursement. Okay. That's not the issue. I'm asking the very basic question that I heard asked, and I wasn't involved in, is that when you are Skyping with a patient, are you delivering the precisely clinical service that's the same as if you were in a face-to-face contact with
yes.
the patient? Well, that's the question that I think is an unanswered question. I would be interested in seeing data that...
Yes, and that is what we and others have studied. That's what we researched. So we picked out, so Zoom Care, we have cured for over 5,000 people for 27 primary conditions that met that test. I'm not saying it's for everything, but I am saying it is for a wide range of primary care services. It does meet the exact test, sir.
Test of being able to code?
No,
of
clinical efficacy and safety.
That's
and the report that we did with OHSU was looking at two things, efficacy and safety, not compensation.
It'd be very useful if you distribute that to us, I think.
Well, and it would be useful if we shared that with you, yes. Of course.
If you could distribute that paper, that would be very helpful.
Yes, we will do that.
Are there questions to this panel?
If I may add to that, we are very interested in clinical outcomes as well, as is the federal government. But one of the things that we've identified is that there are other outcomes other than clinical outcomes that are equally important sometimes to the patient, and those include patient satisfaction outcomes, economic outcomes, and so on. So I think it's important for us to make sure that we maintain that high clinical standard, but also to the extent possible, then make improvements to the patient satisfaction outcomes and the economic outcomes wherever possible.
Commissioner, just one more thing. I just came back from, I was in India for 3 weeks looking at innovative healthcare systems, and I spent time with the Aravind team, provides the leading provider of cataract surgery and eye care throughout India. And I spent a lot of time in remote villages observing their methodology for remote vision care. It's a model where they've demonstrated the quality is completely comparable.
They're doing cataract surgery over television?
No. They're doing initial diagnostics. They're doing glaucoma management.
Right.
You can do all of those things.
I was imagining. Robotics.
People ask me stranger things. It's a day of robotic surgery. Right? You know, it's not unlikely it'll happen in the future. My point is that it's happening globally, and this is a time when you set the table in Oregon. You've brought people into our health system. People are now increasingly insured, and the problem that we face is now covering them on a twice, half, 10 basis. That is twice the health and half the price, and 10 times the delight for the customer. And I'm worried that we're squandering this window by not allowing us to bring in telecare to the service mix for the customer base. I'm worried that we're squandering this great opportunity, this two-year window, to bring all the modern tools to bear to serve the Oregonians. I think that's the question I'm really worried about.
Good question.
Sure.
I love the enthusiasm. Oh, yeah. I love the vision. I think I missed something on the two-year window. Because I'm sorry that I came in late.
Well, just we're thinking that if we... Not passing it this session, it rolls to next session. Pass it next session. We essentially are live and running on January 1, 2016. I saw it as being a two-year window.
Think some federal match or something?
No.
Yeah, we're just delaying what you see as the inevitable or the
I hope it's inevitable. Going. I'm counting.
We were included under this payment for computer, for email interactions as well?
No.
No.
Why not? That's a modern technology.
This is, it actually comes back to the question that you asked earlier, sir. The question was, this is strictly focused at providing care, true medical care, diagnostic care, and therapeutic care for a range of primary care conditions at a lower price with higher degree of access and convenience. And that's the goal of this. We provide today telephone care to do follow-up, and we provide email care to help coordinate care, and that's not what we're asking to cover in this. And this bill would not cover those things.
Hmm. Okay.
Can I, just in closing, I think you're aware that Senator Monis Anderson directed us to create a work group. You can see the things that the makeup of the work group that she asked for, and you can see that Tao is coordinating that. My offer to you is that it's important that we get as much input into this work group as possible. Our Tao's table is always open. And if any of you have an extra 8 hours a month that you'd like to spend over the next 6 months and helping us think about this bill and helping put it together, you can Skype in, you bet.
we have separation of powers in the state. There's no meeting, which is that side of the building and this side of the building.
More powerful, just so
Well, we will be coming back to you and asking midway for your input into the work that's done.
That'd
so,
be, that'd
thank
be
you.
Great. Thank you very much. It's obviously something that's got to be dealt with, and I really would like to see the paper on the clinical outcomes stuff. That's very interesting.
Great. It's coming your way.
So we'll distribute it to the committee. Thank you very much. Oh, yeah. Tom, you really want to talk? You're welcome to.
You asked to.
I know I did.
Do you really want to talk? No.
I mean, you invited that. I asked you to come.
Chair Greenlake and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions. I'm not here really to talk about the bill that was considered and not moved on the other side. I am here to talk about telemedicine and some issues that I think related to it would be worthy of the committee to look at after the work group has done its work or during that time. To begin, I'd say that we would generally associate ourselves with all the wonderful things that Kathy had to say about and others had to say about the value of telemedicine. We're very supportive of it. We pay providers for telemedicine services. At times, that can be a member of ours is someplace where they are not with a physician or in a facility, but the provider they're communicating with is in their office or in a facility. So, you know, some of the old original parameters around telemedicine are starting to fall away by themselves. In Oregon law, there are no barriers per se to allowing to do new and creative things with telemedicine. What the law does is set a floor on what must be paid for in telemedicine. And I think we and I'm sure some of our competitors or many of our competitors have moved beyond that by this time. We're currently working with providers to make sure we have a wider network of providers who are equipped to perform telemedicine services. So it's done in a secure way and all those requirements that need to be met to serve the patient well. We also provide services as part of the price of one's premium. There's at a very fundamental level nurse helplines, but we're looking at other services as well that will be part of the package. Those kinds of approaches did lead us to some concerns about a bill dealing with fee-for-service and in telemedicine. Some issues that I think are worth looking at as we look at where should we be going now in the second decade of the 21st century, having I think last we really took a look at this was at least 5 or so years ago. One is what regulatory barriers may exist to further expansion of telemedicine services. As we've been looking at this, we haven't seen significant ones yet, but you know, it's early in the process, and I think that's worth a look. It's also worth looking at infrastructure, particularly in the rural areas. I know Kathy's organization and others have been very involved in rolling out more broadband-type services to healthcare facilities. But that, when you get down to the possibility of more use of telemedicine in a primary care kind of environment, that probably is something worth looking at from a public policy perspective, and really not limited to healthcare, I think, but access to the infrastructure. If we venture into looking at more parameters around payment, a couple of issues I think are important to consider. One, we're moving very rapidly toward a total cost of care kinds of arrangements with groups of providers. So we're tracking individual encounters, but we and the providers have an agreement between us that they're committing and we're committing to our customers to very low cost trends, and they get rewarded for doing what they need to do with cost and at the same time meeting quality requirements. It's really easy to cut cost if you don't care about quality, and so it's a two-way street on that. And it's so we should be very careful about doing anything that would prop up a fee-for-service system. I think all of us agree is very broken and not very productive in terms of outcomes. And finally, we should take care about not creating either opportunities or requirements for duplicating things that we may already be doing and providing to people who do need to get care in creative ways. We're looking forward to the conversations during the interim, and our encouragement would be to look more broadly at the issue and what we can do to improve the overall healthcare system, including this particular channel of care. It's one of many channels, an important one, and one that we support very much.
Good job. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. You'll be involved with that work group, is that right?
We plan to.
Good. I thought it might interest you. I'm going to close the informational hearing on telemedicine, the next steps, and open a very brief update on the process that avoided Senate Bill 1561, not about Senate Bill 1561. I have you guys reporting, I think, a very good process that maybe we can emulate around here.
The opportunity for kumbaya to end this thing.
Shall we hold hands?
you may, but you don't need to.
Chair Greenlake and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today to give a quick background and an update on where we are with the dispensing issue. My name is Sarah Basler. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association. Just by way of background, the issue of provider dispensing was brought forward as Senate Bill 1561 by a number of associations that represent providers who have dispensing authority. The issue came forward in this short session as the result of a 2013 opinion from the Attorney General that said the Board of Pharmacy has authority that they hadn't previously used to regulate the practice site of any provider with dispensing authority as a retail drug outlet. That change is something that could involve fees, inspections, and additional regulation. That caused concern from providers who have dispensing privileges and from the associations that represent those providers. Currently, providers who have dispensing privileges are regulated by their own licensing boards. So as a quick example, a nurse practitioner who dispenses is regulated by the Oregon State Board of Nursing. To get dispensing privileges, that NP applies to the board. If he or she is granted dispensing privileges, they have to follow all of the rules that OSBN has in place that regulate dispensing. Those rules cover things like labeling, storage, and record keeping. There's also a process a process in place for complaints, and along the way, the Board of Pharmacy is notified when an NP applies to get dispensing privileges, if those privileges are granted, and if there's any complaints. We appreciate that we're here today with an agreement in lieu of a bill. ONA is eager to work in partnership with Mr. Watt and the Board of Pharmacy, and really appreciate their willingness to slow down the rulemaking process and work with all of the stakeholders. We're committed to a long-term solution that both prioritizes and protects patient safety, that avoids redundant regulations on providers, and that doesn't create barriers to patients accessing needed medication.
Chair Grunick, committee. My name is Marcus Watt. I'm the new executive director of the Board of Pharmacy, and as a four-week state employee, I don't have the history or the knowledge of what happened prior to, or what the events were that led up to Senate Bill 1561.
Well, welcome for your first visit here. I'm sure you'll be back on many occasions.
I just want to share that the Board of Pharmacy shares the same goal as the other regulatory boards and the professional associations, and that is that we want to protect and advocate for the safety of the citizens of Oregon. That is our primary goal. Personally, I believe in open, transparent discussion and dialogue, and I am very much committed to that process. In the time since this bill was introduced, we've had some discussions. My board has agreed that, have you shared the document that we...
Okay. Just got it.
My board has agreed that we won't pass no rules until we can resolve this or at the end of the 2015 session, and we look forward to moving on and trying to resolve this while maintaining safety for the citizens of our state.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, Courtney Dresser with the Oregon Medical Association. Thank you for allowing us to quickly testify. We also at the OMA want to thank our partners, the Nursing Association and the Dental Association, and all of the other healthcare provider groups who worked with us this session on this issue. And a special thanks to Mr. Watt for his willingness to have these discussions and slow down this process. As we have these discussions, and we think we have a great opportunity to make sure we first try to address any of the concerns from the Board of Pharmacy through existing oversight structures in place at our professional boards. It will also be important to make sure that these concerns are supported by data, so we don't spend time pursuing solutions in search of a problem that may or may not exist. We want to be careful not to create more burden or more rules that might affect healthcare for folks in rural or underserved areas in our state. So again, we look forward to sitting down with all of our partners during the interim, and hopefully we won't be back here with a bill, and we'll have it taken care of in rules.
Thank you. Mr. Saucy?
Thank you for your time.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. For the record, I am Dan Saucy. I'm the I'm a general dentist here in Salem, and I'm representing the Oregon Dental Association. I'm the chairman of the Government Relations Committee for the Oregon Dental Association. The Oregon Dental Association feels that this is an important issue for dentists and the patients we serve. When the issue first came up, we asked the Board of Dentistry how many complaints had been made in regards to drug dispensing. In the last 10 years, there have been none. Although many dentists do not dispense a lot of drugs, it's important for access to care and to maintain the ability to dispense fluoride, antibiotics, and some other drugs that are directly from our office when necessary. We appreciate the opportunity and are eager to work with other stakeholders to come to a solution.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any questions, any panel? I really do appreciate that effort. It was one that we asked in conjunction with the Senate that folks move together and try and create something in the interim that would work for us all. And I was really very, very pleased. We're all very pleased that you did that. Thank you very much. We will close the informational hearing on the update on Senate Bill 1561 that didn't happen. And we will adjourn for the record.